Okay, welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation and today's event. Thank you for coming in the snow. I'm Penny Duckham and I run the Kaiser Foundation's Media Fellowships Program. And today's event is focused, as you know, on tuberculosis and the global challenge faced in diagnosing, preventing, and treating TB. We are looking in particular at the emergence of highly drug-resistant strains of TB and the particular challenge that they pose. We're lucky today to have with us the producer of a new frontline film, TB Silent Killer, which will air on most PBS stations this evening, and you'll have the chance to see it in full then. And today we're going to watch short clips from the film, and then we're being joined by a group of experts, so we will discuss some of the implications of the film. I think, as many of you know, TB, in particular multi-drug resistant TB, has been described by the World Health Organization, USAID, and others as a public health crisis or emergency, but I'm not sure that you would gain that from the attention that it gets in the media, except perhaps on World TB Day, which of course was yesterday, and there was a flurry of coverage in some outlets at that point, with some 8.6 million people estimated to be contracting TB each year. This is an opportunity for us to focus on the issues. And again, we're very glad to have that chance to do so in conjunction with our colleagues at Frontline. We are going to start today by watching a short clip, which is actually the trailer to the Frontline film. So if we could do so, we will start with that now.
When they told me that she has TB, I felt so miserable. TB is the disease that can kill my sister.
This March, in a special presentation from the stirring landscapes of Swaziland in Africa, Frontline tells the story of a brave and struggling community that has led us into their lives.
They take us away from our homes so that we cannot be dangerous to the people outside.
To shed light on a new epidemic of a very old disease.
The treatment has got severe side effects, which makes it quite difficult for patients to adhere to the treatment.
A disease that is becoming resistant to treatment and is spreading.
In developed countries, they should be threatened with this worldwide spread of TB.
Anyone can get TB. Anyone can die from TB.
An intimate story of people fighting for their lives.
I am deaf because of TB. I lost my parents and my sister because of TB. I've been out of school now because of TB.
Isolated from those they love.
I miss my sister. I miss her a lot.
Stories of courage, loss, and hope that the world will hear.
In 21st century, we shouldn't have people dying from TB.
TB, Silent Killer. A special presentation coming March 25th to Frontline.
Well, and again, welcome to you, Jezza Newman, who is joining us from London and is the producer of this new Frontline film. Jezza, one thing that I think is rather striking is the focus on this film on patients who have actually already gone through the hurdles of being diagnosed and In many ways, the challenge of being diagnosed was indeed the theme of World TB Day yesterday, reached the 3 million who are thought not to have been diagnosed. And even when that has happened and they are getting care, the options for treatment are so extraordinarily limited and grueling. And that's certainly not just the case in Swaziland, but indeed globally. Could you talk a little bit about your experience when you got to Swaziland dealing with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I knew very little about TB myself before I went there. And so it was a learning curve myself. And I think the thing that really struck me, the thing that I found most shocking, was that it's not so much the disease that people are struggling with, it's the treatment. It's quite amazing that actually, when somebody starts on their medication for TB and multidrug-resistant TB, they actually start to get better, and then after a little while, they start to get a lot worse. And worse means that we met people who were suffering from hearing loss, which can often lead to permanent hearing loss. They were vomiting and unable to keep their medication down. They were getting this kind of rheumatism and arthritis in their bones and their joints, which rendered them unable to do the activities they might have been doing previously. So the beggar, a builder we meet in the film, he can't do his job any longer. He's a great soccer fan and he can't play soccer any longer. So their lives are basically falling apart around them. They become very isolated because that friends and family don't want to be associated with someone with this airborne disease because it can spread through the air. And so you get to a point that not only are the doctors on the ground having to deal with treating these patients, but suddenly they've got this huge mental health burden as well, where the patients are becoming highly depressed and to the point that one doctor even told me that she had a patient who committed suicide.
You touched there on this issue of stigma, and while appreciating that obviously TB is extremely contagious, the patients you profile and their families, how difficult was it for you to find people willing to be interviewed?
It's extremely difficult. I mean, the point of making a film like this is that the sadness is really, and the reality is, for a lot of the families who take part in the film, you know, whatever change this film can evoke, it's unlikely to affect their outcomes. You know, they're already struggling, they're already suffering. So there's a real altruistic level everybody's got to have in this. And so you hope that on one level that the filming process can be enjoyable. And that's about myself, Rebecca, who made the film with me, and Sandili, our local fixer. It's about us making sure that we engage with these families beyond just making a film. So there are days that you would go there and not even film. So, I mean, there was one point that Beggy's mother was trying to get the harvest in and the rains were coming. So literally you put the camera down and we were there chucking corn into a pile for 2.5 hours so that it didn't get soaking wet. But that's what you do. I think that's why we can bring a different level of humanity into these films, is because myself and my team around me, and we were just a team of three because I self-shoot everything. So we were there and we have this intimate relationship with them. And so therefore they can see an opportunity to do something good and be part of something that can evoke change. But it takes time to find those people. It's not easy. In the case of Beggy and Zandili, who I mentioned, their mother happened to be someone who worked in the community trying to educate people to use Western medicine and to be open about these things. So in that case, that family was like that, but it took a while to find them. I mean, we had a young boy that we filmed with for nearly 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, his mother said, look, I'm really quite worried about some relatives we have in South Africa. And, you know, can you guarantee to me that this film won't be seen in South Africa? And I'm like, well, no, how can I? You know, even if I was to tell South African broadcasting they can't show it, there's still the internet, there's the web, there's all these mediums, so we had to withdraw. You know, there's no way I could openly film with this child any longer and with this family, and knowing in the back of my mind that, you know, that they would be false promises. So that's hard. You know, you've invested that time in filming and you have to say, oh, well, start again, you know. And but that's part and parcel of what we do, and we understand that when we make these films, you know. And then ultimately, if you take that time and then you meet the right people like Beggy and Zandili, and then like Nokbega and her brother Malusi, then you start to create something much more powerful because everybody's in it together on the right reasons.
Well, that's a great bridge for us to see the second clip, which will just give a short piece of Becky's story. So if we could go to that now.
Isifo se-TB ngicabanga ukuthi siphatha wonke muntu asikhethe. Ngoba nami ngincane. Ngathi ukuthi singaphatha abancane ngoba banani.
When they told me that she has TB, I felt so miserable, so dejected. So bad, because TB, I know TB, it is a common disease which destroy people. If TB isn't treated, it can eventually kill the individual. TB is the disease that can kill my sister.
One day, a monk was sitting on the tallest tree in the forest. Forget it. He is the python.
Their mother died from a multi-drug-resistant mutation of tuberculosis known as MDR-TB. This form of the disease is far harder to treat. Melusi's greatest fear is that Nokbega may also have the drug-resistant strain.
So nice.
She is already being treated for regular TB. Today, the nurse is bringing news about her latest test results.
So Nokbega, sikhwehlela sakhe after afikile lesibhedlela, sasi analyze ukubuka ukuthi ugula unani ngoba bekagula khwehlela ngisho.
Yeah.
Uthi teke naka khwehlela Nokbega, sakhanza ukuthi une TB.
Yeah.
Sakhanza ukuthi le TB lesiyikwamile. Okay. Kuba ne TB lile normal bese kuba nale TB lesiyikwamile.
Mm.
Okay. So Nokbega unale TB lesiyikwamile. Mm. Le TB ke lesiyikwamile ayisa treatwa kalula njengale TB le normal. Okay. Yona sekudzingeka ukuthi ajove sikhathi lesithe. Ukhanza ngokuthi kuba bo 4 to 6 months esikhathini lesiningi.
The brother and sister share one room. So to protect Malusi from catching the potentially lethal infection, Nokubega now has to go and live in an isolation hospital 2 hours away.
Ngifuna nalaye esibhedlela inyanga. Kuthi esikolweni sekude.
Yes, nayo vele ngi. Uvang Jan says, which is all your spending. Not bad. Since that, we go to city, humble spending as full of the Bamnage Gilegash, here. But the corner of Jova Gash, but the corner of my police, Akuana Tigash.
So we're being joined now by, to my right, Dr. Christine Sizemore, the chief of the TB, leprosy, and microbacterial diseases section at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, and sitting next to her, Jonathan Gass, who is currently a monitoring and evaluation specialist at Ariadne Labs in Boston, and was prior to that working for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, in Swaziland, amongst other countries. And last but not least, my colleague, Josh Michaud, who is the Associate Director of the Kaiser Foundation's Global Health Policy Program. So, Jonathan, I'm going to turn to you now. It's quite hard watching this film, partially because the patients are brave, and in this particular instance, a very young girl. But it's also hard. The clips didn't cover it in much detail, but the film itself does. It's very hard for the doctors and the nurses and the providers in the field. And given your experience specifically in Swaziland, but in the field, can you talk a bit about the toll this very limited treatment set of options plays into the lives of the providers?
Sure. So starting off, I think, one of the biggest issues is that diagnostics for TB, up until very recently, are very archaic methods for diagnosing the disease as well as for detecting resistant strains of the disease. And so that lengthens the time from detection to actually getting a patient onto treatment. Secondly, the regimens that we use to treat the disease were developed over 50 years ago. And again, they're quite outdated and very toxic, as Jezza talked about, with multiple side effects, which he went into, which include psychosis, deafness, nausea, vomiting, et cetera. And then in addition to that, it just takes a very serious toll on the patient's lives because the treatment duration is so long. So for drug-sensitive TB, which is your normal quote-unquote TB treatment, it's about 6 months or more, 6 to 8 months of treatment. And with drug-resistant, multi-drug-resistant TB, the treatment duration is anywhere between 18 and 24 months of treatment. And so obviously this takes an incredible toll on the patient's lives. They have to oftentimes stop working, et cetera. And of course, witnessing it on the ground and seeing not only the toll that TB has had, drug-resistant TB has had in Swaziland, but also the concomitant effects of HIV, TB co-infection, is quite a tragedy in Swaziland right now.
Just watching both for journalists and indeed providers in the field, the main protection is to wear a mask, but that means, of course, people can't really see you very clearly. So. Am I missing something, or is that really the main preventive step you both really take?
You have to take obviously precautions by wearing a mask whenever you're in airspace with a patient. And I think Jezza, we were on a panel previously, and he explained it quite well that, you know, when you're interacting with a patient or when you're a filmmaker and you're interacting with a subject, you look at people's mouths, and it's one of the way that humans sort of detect emotion and, develop a sense of trust between the clinician and the patient, et cetera. And when you're completely covered up with a mask and, there's a small child like Nokbega that you see in the film, of course she's going to be crying and a bit scared of the process. But you have to take primary precautions for yourself.
But it is difficult because, as you can imagine, you're there to capture people's lives. And part of the process too, not only do you wear a mask, but if you go into any of the Doctors Without Borders clinics, they've got special vents in the ceiling, so there's through flow of air, so you have at least 3 points of aeration in the clinic itself. And then in the National TB Hospital that I filmed in, you're supposed to limit your time on the wards. So you should only really spend 15 to 20 minutes at a time and then go and spend 10 minutes out in fresh air. But, you know, you imagine I was filming with Nokibega on the ward, and at one point she was telling us, you know, her heartfelt memories of her mother, you know, and remember her mother only passed away 2 weeks prior to us arriving there. And she's telling us about her mother and the stories and what she remembered about her. And, you know, it gets to 19 minutes and 58 seconds. You can't go, oh, sorry, Nutmegger, I'm going to leave now, get my fresh air, and can you just hold that thought? You know, it's, so, you know, you have to follow certain protocols, but of course, you've got to know what risks you take and how you bend them. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, we have a choice to be there. We have a choice to do what we do. Jonathan has a choice to work in the field he works in. He could work in a different field. I have a choice to be there as a filmmaker. I could make a different film. Nokbega, Malusi, you know, Zandilis, and all the others, they have no choice. You know, they're there, come not may. They don't get on a plane and go back to their homes in nice, comfortable Western America or UK, you know, and I think that's the point. So, and we're conscious of that, you know, as people on the ground, and that's the amazing thing about people like Jonathan and the other doctors and nurses on the front, you know, they are amazing people doing amazing work, working against these conditions day in, day out, and it is a hard toss-up about what you do on patient care, on a basic human level.
Did you feel, Jonathan, the sort of sense of urgency that this is indeed recognized as a public health emergency crisis, both within the country of Swaziland and by all of us in the rest of the world?
I mean, in Swaziland, there's no doubt about it that there's a definite sense of emergency. The Swazi government several years back invited MSF to come into the country to provide technical assistance with their provision of treatment for drug-resistant TB because they didn't have the capacity to fund it, to staff it, et cetera. And as I said before, with the HIV problem in Swaziland, they're already, you know, pushing their funds towards that, and so it's quite limited in their resources. So MSF's stance is basically we want to get the word out about TB globally. This isn't just a problem in Swaziland. This is a problem in low and middle income countries and some high income countries as well. Funding for treatment is completely prohibitive, especially in low and middle income countries right now. And so we want to give a call to action that this is an issue that people suffer with. And the biggest problem that I see is that many of the suffering around the world is amongst the poor, and the poor don't really have a voice. And so it's our role to sort of give them that voice and put forth a TB manifesto that we're going to present at the World Health Assembly in May to call for increased research and development for new comprehensive TB regimens, which I think we'll get into later talking about the drugs that we use to treat, and shorter duration treatments with less side effects. Adherence is a huge, huge problem, and of course, one that patients can afford because the poor shouldn't be shut out from receiving treatments as well.
That's a great segue to you, Christine. So Christine is, of course, on the front lines of research and development in this field. And could you start by just briefly giving us a sense of the challenge? Is the challenge a lack of funding or priority for research and development in this field? Or is it, or perhaps coupled with that, is it the complexity, in fact, of this multi-drug resistant strain or strains of TB?
I think it's probably a combination of all, because TB, as you know, or it might not know, is actually a fairly complicated disease. It's not a matter of getting infected, you get disease, you get over it, you're done. And you protect it for life, you can't catch it again. TB is sort of like almost like a dynamic process. You can carry the infection without being ill, you can never develop disease, or you could develop tuberculosis, and then you have to go on prolonged treatment. But that treatment taking up to 2 years for drug-resistant TB or 9 months for regular TB, we don't know why that really is. All we know is that the bacterium stops to respond somehow to therapy, which requires those long therapeutics. So in order for us to develop new drugs and, you know, also vaccines and diagnostics, we need to understand a lot more about TB as the disease and especially how the bacterium behaves. Because you can't target drugs effectively against the growth of the bug, of course, if you don't know what it does or where it is. So those are a lot of the areas that research is involved in, and unfortunately it's a very complicated process. Also, to learn more about human disease, you have to have a chance to have products that have made it far enough into the clinic. Because only once you know what they do in humans can you actually go back and look at the science and say, could I have predicted this? Did I predict the candidates properly? Or what is it that we have to improve to actually get better drugs out there? So it's a very iterative process. But the good thing is we have gotten to a stage where actually products are now being evaluated in humans. So it's a unique opportunity right now to learn a lot from those.
And can you talk a bit more about that? Because we've talked briefly before this event about diagnostics, treatment, prevention, and indeed vaccines. So I'm asking you to cover rather a lot in a very short period of time about what might be in the pipeline and what we should be hopefully looking for. But where would you start if we were going to?
I think, of course, with a positive note, because when you look at the realities of TB and how difficult disease is, and especially as was very powerfully shown in this film, how brutal the second-line therapy is on the patients and the fact that they get sicker from the drugs than they are actually from the disease, I think it's heartening to see that we have candidates in the pipeline right now. Some of those have been approved for very special use for patients that have no other treatment options. But I think one thing we have to realize that in order to really make a big difference in tuberculosis, only focusing on people with already disease and trying to get them better is almost like putting band-aids on to prevent the disease in the first place and to diagnose it early enough before the infections happen, especially in the households where the mom infects the children, that then go on to infect others potentially. To have a vaccine and to understand what it actually takes for the human immune system to fight the bacterium once there's an infection. That is, of course, almost like the holy grail in biomedical research at the moment. But again, it's very complicated because, as I said, you can get TB more than once. So you're not lifelong. You don't have a lifelong protection. A lot of people never get disease. They keep the infection in their body without symptoms. So you need to understand what's different between them. Why is it that some people get TB and some don't? And to tease that out again requires a lot of studies actually that involve human volunteers and communities, and then to figure out what is it scientifically that actually I can learn from these processes. And that's where a lot of the efforts in science are actually going on, and it's often referred to as biomarker research. We may have heard that term. And all it says is to try to characterize the various stages of tuberculosis and say what molecules could we tease out of the body that indicate you're infected, but you might not get disease. Or you're infected, but you can protect yourself. And then try to develop products that basically say, can we mimic this? Or how do we address the bacterium? How can we kill the bug? And it's sort of this interplay between all those disciplines that is really necessary to provide the underlying science that then helps us to create the products. But we work in, at least the investigators that we are supporting at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, we support them in all aspects of science. So it's very hard to say prioritize. Where do you prioritize? Because you need all those disciplines. And they learn from each other. And that is where basically we're trying to put our focus to do more for product development and fundamental science.
Well, I'm going to draw you in here, Josh, because yesterday the Financial Times had a special section on TB and described TB as the poor relation of global diseases. And I think that, you know, sort of stems from a number of different factors, but clearly one issue is the adequacy of the funding and the role that the US plays in this as a very generous donor in global health, typically across the board. But could you talk more about the funding issues and where things stand specifically in relation to TB?
Sure, yeah. I think there's a paradox when it comes to TB and the support that it receives. If you look at the overall global trends on the epidemiology of TB, they're positive. The Millennium Development Goals, for example, called for a reduction in TB deaths, the rate of TB death
from 1990 until 2015 of reducing it by 50%. And at a global level, we're over 40% reduction from the 1990 baseline, which indicates that there's been some significant progress. And certainly some countries where there's a large TB burden have made significant progress, China being a shining example of that. So there's been this great progress, yet there is still this massive unmet need. And the World Health Organization estimates that annually about $8 billion is needed to fully fund TB programs in low and middle income countries. Yet we're very far from that figure. And if you add everything together at the global level, again, we're talking about maybe $4 to $5 billion. And so there's a big resource gap, and that's always been present in TB. And it looks difficult to fill in the years to come. As far as the US government goes, it's a very important funder of TB programs, and I'll separate out the programs, support for programs in countries from the research and development portfolio that Christine's been talking about. And on the support to program side, the US government has identified and is working with about 26, 27 countries and supporting them through funding that's provided oversight by USAID mostly. And that supports the prevention, the diagnostic, and the treatment programs in these countries. And they're really focusing on the high burden countries. So in the last few years, it's really been ramped up since about 2000. But it reached a peak funding level for these for the USAID global health funding of about $250 million in 2012. And since then, it's been stable at that level and gone down a little bit. And the president released a budget request for fiscal year 2015, which is the first step in the budget process for determining the actual funding level, which will come after Congress appropriates that money. And of course, there's a lot of time between now and then. In that presidential funding request for TB programs, it was set at a level of $191 million, which represents a significant cut. Of course, that's not the final figure, but there's concern about the fact that there is a cut in global TB programs just when there is a recognition of we may be at a turning point in terms of diagnostics, in terms of different approaches in TB, and whether that's going to be enough to really fill the resource gap that's out there.
I don't know whether you would also touch, Josh, on, while the film is focused on Swaziland, clearly this is by no means confined to Southern Africa as a problem, and perhaps you could just briefly give us a sense of how this plays out across the world and indeed the implications for the U.S.
Well, the first part of that, yeah, Swaziland is recorded the highest rate of TB among countries, according to the World Health Organization, which is really the source of information about TB. Now, this idea of the 3 million missed is interesting. So, if 8.6 million people are thought to have developed TB disease, yet we're missing 3 million of those. That 8.6 million estimate is based upon sort of an extrapolation or modeling, and it's based upon a foundation of incomplete information. So it's very difficult to know exactly what the burden is, and the more you look for it, meaning TB and MDR-TB in particular, the more you tend to find. So many people aren't counted in those estimates. So any estimates that you do see out there are best guesses, and they're based on the best information that's available, but are often revised or should be revised, and with more complete information, we'd have a better idea. So the global TB problem, the highest rates are included are in many of the countries in Southern Africa and also Asia. If you're looking at TB, both drug sensitive and drug resistant TB. If you're talking about drug resistant TB, MDR-TB in particular, the highest rates are found actually in Eastern and Central Europe. In fact, in countries like Moldova, there are estimates of one third of the TB, the newly diagnosed TB cases in those countries, being multi-drug resistant, which presents, of course, a very significant public health challenge.
Christine, can you speak a little bit about the challenge of diagnosing, and particularly the efforts to find quicker diagnostic tools.
Yeah, it's a very important issue. And right now, the best way or the most frequently used way of diagnosing TB is really focused on detecting the bacterium in the sputum of patients. But what that, of course, means is that if you don't have pulmonary TB and I can't isolate the bacterium, or I have very low levels of the bacterium in sputum, I won't find TB either. So what's necessary is almost to go away from the necessity of looking at a very specific sample that the patient has to provide that has a lot of bacteria in it. So the research that's ongoing and that will be required to really improve diagnosis is to say, how else can I identify whether someone either carries the infection, is not yet ill, or has TB that may not necessarily be pulmonary TB? Because once you have pulmonary TB, of course, you excrete the bacteria and you can infect others. How can I catch patients earlier? But beyond the tools that are necessary is really, again, the science. Like, what molecules do I really or can I find in the body that indicate the various stages of disease? Because in diagnostics, the difficulty is that you have to merge technologies, which is basically the platforms. Like, is it a little strip that you can put a piece, a drop of blood on, or any other sample? So you have the technology, but you've got to know what to look for. And what do you put in that diagnostic? How do you actually populate almost like the technology with the biological molecules so that it identifies TB? And that requires a different type of marriage in science almost that you need in drug development and vaccines, because you need technologists and you need scientists, and they have to be able to talk to each other. So there's a lot of effort that's going on in that area in science to really assure that we're not dependent on just bacteria coming out of lung infections, but also detect the bug when it's in the body and it's not otherwise visible, and can take blood or urine or something that's very easy for the patient to produce to help with the earlier and faster diagnosis.
I'm going to open this up in a minute to questions, and we will have two roving mics going round. But while we just wrap up this first part of the panel discussion, I guess my question to you, Jezzer, is why did you go to Swaziland, beyond the fact that this is obviously a big challenge in Swaziland? And
so, I mean, I have a tradition of making films to make a difference. The ethos of the company True Vision that I work with and films I made in the past was basically to give the voice to the voiceless, or find something that's happening in a society that can benefit from a voice and can evoke change. So I've worked in Zimbabwe, China, Tibet, Gaza. I made a film here in the US on poverty. And that was told through the eyes of children, and that was very much about, you know, their future education, etc. And also, when Doctors Without Borders mentioned about TB and brought it to our attention, and I looked into it, I could see this really was something that was neglected, that wasn't at the forefront of people's agendas, and that there's a very human and real story there. You know, there's a real human cost to what's going on, and at that point, I feel that that's where I can do something. Where you have an issue that people have been bringing reports about, there's facts and figures, and they're landing on desks and becoming coffee cup holders. You know, that's when I can make a difference, because I can bring the human face of the issue, and combine that with the reports and get the reports, the stats, the facts. Let the guys who are good at that do that. I'll bring the human cost of what we're talking about, put them together, and surely people have to sit up and listen. And that's why I saw here in Swaziland there was a place to do it, and there was a place to get understanding and try and get this on a level. I mean, this is the thing that we tried to do in looking at the characters that we have in the film and the people that we followed. You know, if you look at the idea that Beggy loves soccer and soccer's his church, you know, for me that would bring that home a bit, because I get it. You know, I get that, you know, Americans have busy, crazy lives, and they're going to come home from work and it's 10 o'clock at night, this is going to go on television, and I'm asking you to watch something that's quite a hard watch that you've got to invest in, and it's like, how can I make that something that you can get something from, not just learn about this strange place, and how can I bring Swaziland into your living room? And And that's about the people that are in the film. If you see Beggy, you'll identify him with him. You know, how many people have had Monday night football and get what he's talking about, his church? And if you look at Little Knot Beggar, who loves flowers, loves the color pink, plays with dolls and dances, she could be any little girl next door. And I think that, you know, if we can get that right and follow those kids and give justice to their stories, then hopefully people will be captured into this. And the adage is, if I can capture the heart, your heads will follow. And so that's the premise of what we're trying to do. And ultimately, I saw that Swaziland TB was something where I felt that I could make a difference and my team could make a difference, Rebecca and Sandile, that, you know, we could do something that could hope to evoke change. And you've got to remember, when we talk about these regimes, this treatment, I think it's really important to bear in mind that by the time Knot Beggar, when you see her in the film, will have finished her treatment, she will have had up to 240 injections and consumed 14,600 pills. Well, how many people out there struggle to take their multivitamin, you know, and that's not a lifesaver. You know, so you can really see what we're talking about is really real issues, really real problems. And it always seems that with TB, from what I've learned on the ground, is we seem to be one step behind all the time. We talk about diagnostics are touched on here. You know, they brought out a machine called the Gene Expert. It was supposed to be the holy messiah of diagnostics, that now they don't need to grow a culture for 6 weeks. They can find it out in 3 days. It's too late in Swaziland. There are already strains of MDR that are not picked up on Gene Expert. So, you know, that's just another case of, yes, great stuff is being done, and let's not diminish the work that's being done, but the fact is it's too little too late at the moment. We need to start being proactive, and I think that's the issue in the West. I've seen that time and time again, and I'm guilty of it. We're reactive. We wait for the flood to happen and the houses are washed away and the people's lives are destroyed before we do anything. With TB, I think that everyone would agree that really we can't wait until it's a problem here in America. Because if you do, it's a serious problem. Because these guys ain't going to be able to give you a new drug in a day. You know, so it's something that needs to be invested in now to stop it. It really needs to be one of those issues that we're preactive about, we're preemptive about, we're not reactive.
But Jonathan, as new drugs and new diagnostics do come down the pipeline, they're obviously the challenge for the people in the field to incorporate that into the treatment regimen and not allow new resistance to emerge. So could you just address that?
Yeah, so like I said before, these sort of old TB drugs, or this category of old drugs that we use to treat drug-sensitive and drug-resistant TB in sort of different combinations, have obviously produced some level of resistance and multiple strains that are out there. And the worry is that there are two specific new drugs that have been developed by pharmaceutical companies that have, that will be incorporated into current regimens with old drugs that have a resistance profile to them already. So the idea being that one drug mixed with these old drugs that are all we have right now but not good enough, is simply not a very comprehensive improvement for the regimen as a whole. And also these two new drugs that have come out have quite low barriers for resistance themselves. So I don't know if that gets to exactly what you were asking, but...
It raises the issues, and Josh, maybe you have...
I wanted to add... thinking on what Jezza and what you had said, you know, it's amazing to me that in the film it's depicted that the health system is working fairly well in that it can diagnose or at least work with patients such as are shown in the film and have the drugs available to treat those patients in a TB hospital that has, you know, functioning, fairly level of high functioning, you know, beds are made, et cetera, it's clean, it's got windows and that were, you know, that's not necessarily the case in TB programs. And while a reflection of the funding gap that's out there, I think in many places you don't even see that level. And maybe it's a testament to MSF help working with the Swazi government, the Ministry of Health on this, that it's working so well. Now, there are global funders out there. The World Health Organization is working on this. The Global Fund support is the largest donor in support of TB programs out there. They provide 60% of the donor support for TB programs, but even that, it's not enough. So it's a reflection. It's almost an anomaly in a way.
Well,
in certain places, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it was a lesson that the Swazi government had learned from other countries. And in fact, when you speak to Temba, who runs a TB program there, he's very proud of the fact that they have not had stoppage in drug supply. So drug supply, he saw how that had caused serious problems in other countries. So that was something that they were quite keen on, was the drug supply. Obviously, MSF has supported that in a big way, but the big other element is that what they really want to do and what they've learned through Doctors Without Borders is that decentralized care is really the way to go. That you don't want people traveling on multiple buses like Little Nog Bega does in the film to get to hospital, because then she could be infecting people all the way there. So they want to have this decentralized care program. So for them, that's the issue. That's, MSF completely propped that up in Swaziland. They have the 4x4s that go out to the villages with MSF, Doctors Without Borders, personnel on board, and injecting families outside in the rural areas. And that's the thing that Swaziland is finding really hard to deal with. So they've maintained a good drug supply, but if Doctors Without Borders left tomorrow, they'd have no way of getting those drugs to the patients. And that's their issue. Their issue is they need funding for that. So each country, like you say, yes, on the face of it, it looks like it's working, but it's not working completely. And I think anyone in the country would also argue that because it went on for so long, there are so many patients out there in Swaziland who are yet to be diagnosed.
Right.
Do you want to comment on that, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that, the National TB Hospital, as you saw in that clip, looks all built up, and it's there as a resource, and there are drugs, as you say. But when I was there, for example, there was a 3 or 4 month period where every single nurse in that entire hospital went on strike, and the patients were just lying in their beds. And that's the reality of the situation, because the nurses didn't have personal protective equipment for themselves to buy. So maybe there were drugs, and through the drug pipeline came down, but a nurse that doesn't wear a mask is going to be a nurse who's ultimately infected with TB or drug-resistant TB. And so they band together, and they decided to go on strike, which is obviously a huge issue because they're already underpaid as it is. So they're going without payment for a while. And MSF stood in and continued the operation in the hospital for some time. But there's obviously stigma attached to it. Nurses feel that they want to be paid more because they're at higher risk treating patients with drug-resistant TB, et cetera. So, I mean, it's a very complex issue, yeah.
And in the context of the film, so you understand, of course, there are lots of issues. Like, so in Swaziland, it's HIV that causes the lowered immune system to give you the full-blown disease. But that's not the case necessarily in Eastern Bloc countries, where it could be living conditions, or it's not necessarily the case in China or India. Okay, but I'm looking at a micro story. So I have to tell this, in the back of my mind, the whole time we're putting the film together, is I don't want to let you off the hook. I don't want you to go, oh, well, it's only HIV. We don't have HIV. We don't need to worry about that. I don't want you to go into it and go, oh, well, the hospital, well, it's the government. They're not paying their nurses correctly. That's why there's TB. It's their fault. It's Swaziland's fault. We don't need to worry about that. So you have to be really, really conscious the whole way through that I don't want you to be heading off on a path in one direction or the other, which is why, and it comes up. I've had people, even Kez Keys, who runs the TB, for MSF in Swaziland, he said to me, well, you don't really cover decentralized care properly, do you? And it's kind of, well, no, Keys, but the point is that neither of my characters got treated in that way. They actually went to the hospital. So you can't cover everything, but you have to be really conscious that the viewer isn't taken off on a different path. So, obviously in these discussions, these things come out, but when you watch it in the context of the film, I want you to be engaged primarily with Notbega, with Malusi, with Zandili, with Beggy, with all these people with real names and real lives who have real hopes and real desires for the future. So what you take away from it is, my goodness, really? Is that what's going on? And how you can engage in that in a way that will make you want to look at this further and maybe read into it more and then learn the things that the Joshes of the world can tell you, And so that's the point within the context of a film. You're trying to, in a way, you're trying to make this incredibly complicated story as simple as possible.
And on that, I'm going to open this up to questions from the floor. If you would, there are roving mics. If you could speak into the microphone And if you would introduce yourself and before you ask a question, I appreciate that we've all seen the film and you haven't, but all the more reason to watch this evening.
Hi, my name is Sharon Layden. I'm with Summit Strategies. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the pipeline and what needs to be done in terms of encouraging private pharmaceutical companies to get involved with this, what the balance is between public and private investment, and how you address the fact that you're hitting a moving target. So somebody may be developing a drug to target what is a current strain, and by the time that drug is through the pipeline and gets approved, you now have a new MDR strain that you're fighting against and you're still behind the curve.
Very good questions, and I try to keep the answer manageable. So when you look at the current pipeline, it is focused, of course, on individual drugs. But what is often not reflected in the pipeline is that there are also a variety of organizations that are trying to develop new regimens from the beginning. So not one drug at a time that you then combine or add to existing drugs, but say, if we shuffled the deck completely differently, can we come up with new regimens that are able to treat the disease either faster or with fewer side effects? That is a big effort that's going on in the field as well. The balance between public and private investment, and especially the issue of pharmaceutical companies involved in tuberculosis program, tuberculosis drug development, is unfortunately a difficult one, and not just limited to tuberculosis, but infectious diseases in general. Because there's this perception, and it's probably from a pharmaceutical perspective, a true statement that the market may be too limited. It takes a lot of money to make a drug, and one could argue that if I can't recover my costs, it's not worth for me to be in the game. That said, though, that the drugs that were just recently approved provisionally to help people without other treatment options who have MDR-TB came from large pharmaceutical companies. But there are also smaller biotech companies in public-private partnerships that are working in that space. So the balance, and especially our contributions at National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, since we are one of the largest funders of biomedical research in that space, is we try to help people what we call de-risk their products. And it's basically, if you have an interesting candidate, but you're lacking the resources to get either medical evidence or information so that you can take it into the clinic, we try to help them to get to that stage with the expectation that then there are other funders and other partners who take on those molecules or those regimens to develop them further. So in the TB product development area, luckily there is a consortium or a good collaboration among the largest funders or the major funders, pharmaceutical industries, biotechs, public-private partnerships, and then also some of the more patient communities to say, how can we really populate every step along the way to drive new products to patients as fast as we can? Is it easy? Absolutely not. Very challenging, takes a lot of time, and a lot of products fail. And that's, I think, where one of the issues that you have pointed out earlier is it's going to take some time to get new drugs. It's not a matter of if you throw a lot of money at an issue, you can force innovation. It's almost like steady support, steady effort, and emphasis on new products development, and recognizing that things will fail, but the community has been able to learn from failed clinical trials, from lessons learned in vaccines, in diagnostics, and drugs to say, okay, how are we going to do it better? So the need is there, the emphasis is there, are all the players at the table? Not always, but so far we've been able to at least do what we can with the resources available.
Questions? Hi, my name's Ralph Paez. It would seem important to identify the carriers who show no symptoms. Is there any work being done in that area, how do you test an entire population to determine the carriers?
Yeah, that's actually another very good question, and one that's, again, a combination of science, technologies, and then also the realities of tuberculosis in the field. Because even if you had a tool to say, I can identify all the carriers, you need someone who produces it, someone who can sell it, and then programs that can actually apply it to people. So how do you say, who do I test? but the emphasis on trying to find out who carries the bacterium without having disease is actually by the research community taken up very seriously and is one of the priority areas of multiple funders. It's basically, if we can detect individuals with the highest chance of progressing to tuberculosis, we can give them even the existing prophylactic treatments. There are drugs that you can take for several months, and they should at least prevent the initial episodes of the disease. But again, since you can get TB more than once, this is not a one-time process. You affect it once, we may be able to deal with it, you can get it again. So in the end, focusing on those individuals, I think, is a good goal, but having a vaccine that prevents disease from occurring in the first place in all types of individuals, infected or not infected, would probably be the most effective tool that we can get our hands on and working on developing. So all the other aspects, again, are important, but maybe harder to implement, again, than having an effective vaccine.
I'd add that, yeah, there's the tool aspect, and then there's the public health practice, which you mentioned. But, you know, there are certain public health practices which are practiced in this country, for example, of contact tracing, where if you have a TB diagnosis, you go out and find who that person is maybe in contact with. That may not necessarily be the practice in countries, mainly due to resource constraints. And so that is where you would find a lot of additional cases. And I don't know if you saw that there's been an announcement made about children and TB and how the estimates that are out there previously. Yesterday, there was a study was published saying that there's an estimate now of 1 million children with TB, which was double the previous estimate out there. And it was really a matter of building a better evidence base. And one of the aspects of contact tracing is often if you have an adult with TB, then a child within a household who may also have TB, but that's not necessarily followed up on in every case. In this country, yes, but other countries, not necessarily.
Do you have anything to add to that, Jonathan? I wondered whether, you know, what's the practice in...
Yeah, I mean, in Swaziland in particular, we do contact tracing, of course, especially with children. One of the biggest issues is that pediatric patients don't necessarily produce mycobacterium in their sputum. So we have to go to sort of an extra level of investigation and do a gastric lavage or what have you in order to test to diagnose them with the disease. And so there's an added issue with the pediatric patients there, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit, Christine, about TB treatment in this country and the degree to which it is totally comparable or different from what we've been talking about in the context of Swaziland or other countries?
I can touch on it. It's not our area. We don't provide, at my institute, we don't provide treatment, but we work, of course, with our colleagues at the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. And the few instances that I'm aware of where patients, especially with very complicated tuberculosis or multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, were treated, is that we have the advantage of providing what you might kind of call individualized therapy. And that is, patients are really watched very closely for how much drug they have to take, how high the drug levels in the blood are they most effective against the bacterium. So I think patients in the U.S. actually have great advantages because they don't get a standardized cocktail of drugs until they respond. But if they're not responding properly, we can switch things, we can dose higher, we can manage the side effects, because that's one thing that's often not addressed in TB treatment is it's not just having the drugs available to treat the disease, but how do you manage the side effects? Can you give a patient something so they don't vomit and they can keep their drugs down? So in the U.S., I think we're actually in a very fortunate place. Globally, TB care is often highly standardized, and before someone is identified with drug-resistant TB, it's not just a matter of getting a diagnostic test that says your bug is resistant, but they failed therapy for drug-sensitive TB multiple times. They keep getting drugs for 9 months, they don't get better. They get it again, they still don't get better, and then they become suspect. And at that point, they have drug-resistant TB. If this developed during therapy or if they came with it, they've already infected a lot of other individuals. So there is this individualization of being able to really cater to individual patients' needs, as we do in the U.S., I think is not available elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Question at the back. Yeah.
My name is Ben Brown from Results for Development Institute here in DC. I was hoping any of the panelists could share a success story or two from a low or middle income country at a district level or a country level where you've seen programs have achieved a high degree of success.
One example I referenced already, which was China, since 2000 has made a lot of investments in its public health infrastructure and looking about TB in particular. And they've exceeded the Millennium Development Goal reduction of, they've achieved a greater than 50% reduction in their TB death rate, which is quite a remarkable, you know, they still have a very large number of TB cases and a lot of work to do, but the progress made in China has been somewhat of a success story. At least it's an example of if you invest in public health and infrastructure, and TB is often an indicator of a lack of investment in public health infrastructure and an indicator of poverty, where health systems aren't that strong. Another example might be Brazil at a country level.
And I'll just top on that for a second, that I actually think the question is very good, because it's important that we also focus on the success stories. And there are successes, of course. Patients can get cured. And we have a campaign at MSF called TB and Me, which is an online resource for both lay people and patients themselves and clinicians to go on and write about their experiences either with TB, treating TB, having a family member with TB, multi-drug resistant TB, et cetera. And there's plenty of patients on there that have successfully achieved a cure at the end of their very laborsome treatment. But I do think it is good to also focus on those that did make it through that battle. So
yeah, and actually in the context of the film, once you get to see the film, there is a point in the film where there's a group session in the clinic, and there's a lot of MDR sufferers and their carers there in the group session. And in fact, the person running the group session is an MDR survivor. So she was someone that was treated successfully in Swaziland. And then what she does is she's used by Doctors Without Borders to, you know, to do this mental health therapy with the patients. So they are constantly getting feedback and saying, hey, look, this is tough, this is hard, we know it, and I know it because I've been through it, but I'm here today to talk about it. So, you know, of course, that there are those, and then that is then used to try and, you know, help people get through it.
Other questions?
I'm Dan Collins. I'm with the Lilly Foundation. Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. It's been great. Knowing that the U.S. government's gone down in its funding and probably won't go up too much, if you were, I'd be interested in all the panelists' perspective on this, if you were in control of that budget, and to say what would be the one or two things that you would focus on where the real solution opportunities are, and knowing some of these things may not be budget dependent, what would be the greatest bang for the buck, do you think, in resolving or at least making the most progress towards resolving issues primarily around MDR-TB?
Well, I'm going to avoid your question completely and answer a different question, and that is, I mentioned the decline in the request for the bilateral budget, but the U.S. of course supports the multilateral global fund. You know, for significant funding levels, and there has been an increasing emphasis on using a multilateral instrument like the Global Fund for HIV, but also TB. Now, within that portfolio of the Global Fund, TB is around 16, now bumped up to 18% of the funding for the Global Fund. So, compared to HIV and malaria, it's the smallest proportion. So, but that becomes a very critical, part of the global funding level and of the U.S. contribution to TB control. And there are, within that global fund portfolio, efforts to both address MDR-TB and also this relationship between HIV and TB. In fact, countries with high burdens of TB and HIV are now required to submit joint proposals on those two for funding. So I'm sorry I didn't answer your question, but I don't know if anybody else has anything.
I just want all the money. I think, I mean, a good answer would be that this gene expert diagnostic machine that Jezza spoke of also tests for resistance to one of the, or to two of the first line medications that we use. And it's able to diagnose someone within, I believe, 2 hours. So you have the patient who won't leave your clinical environment that you can then start on treatment either right away or start them counseling and developing a treatment plan, et cetera. And I believe it's 3 times more likely to get, I mean, they've done these sort of studies saying that if you're diagnosed using GeneXpert, you're 3 times more likely to get treatment on time than if you're diagnosed with these sort of more archaic methods. The problem is the GeneXpert machine has gone down in price significantly, but it's still very, very, very expensive. So.
You're going to take a stab?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And actually, this, because we get that question a lot, believe it or not, what is the highest priority and where should you focus and where should you put all your money for the biggest bang? And I think the way we try to manage this question in our minds is often to start with 2 categories, public health and patients. If you look at the public health impact that you can make in TB, which is basically prevent new cases from occurring, it's there are multitude of approaches you could take, diagnose faster, treat faster, have a vaccine. But then you look at the patients, and the reality of the patients is we tend to focus on you are a patient when you have advanced pulmonary disease or multidrug resistant TB. But you also have family members that need to be protected. You have communities that need to be protected. You have people who want to be diagnosed any faster. So once you start prioritizing and saying, I should put all my money into drugs, you're focusing on individuals with disease. Doesn't work. I'm only focusing on diagnostics means I'm still only focusing on people with only disease, but you're not working on the patient level of I don't want to get disease in the first place. So to prioritize and say, if we had better drugs, problem solved, not the case. With better diagnostics, again, it's not going to help you either. So, and I think when you, if you follow the global strategies for tuberculosis control, and especially the modeling that is in those documents, it's very clear that one individual intervention or one type of intervention is not going to be sufficient. So it's you have to almost like focus in multiple dimensions. You need the new drugs, the new regimens, the vaccines, the diagnostics, and the underlying science that actually gets you to that place. And the post-2015 global strategy for tuberculosis got simplified quite a bit. It's going to rest on 3 pillars, a third of which is supposed to be improved research to help facilitate product development. So to focus in one area or the other and saying we need to invest more here will take away from the other areas. So it's not something, when you look at it from a higher level perspective, it's not something that is probably going to get us the results that we want.
Jezza, want to take a stab on the U.S. budget?
Yeah, well, as a filmmaker, I am such an expert in these things, but I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you can put logic to it. I mean, ultimately, there's a lot of people doing a lot of important things, and they all need money. And this is a global threat, and it's happening across the globe. So, I mean, I think the reality is the only way it's ever going to get to the point that everybody wants it to be is there needs to be a forum of all the experts. So the R&Ds need to get together with those implementing it in country, and we need to map out the world and go, right, Swaziland, what do we need there? Our serious issue there is decentralized care. Right, so we know we need a budget for that there. What do we need in Eastern Bloc? What do we need in India? What do we need in... And they need to sit down together and go, right, we've got this amount of money and we need to do this amount of on-the-ground stuff. Right, how much can we then put into developing the next bit, the new drugs, the vaccinations? And it needs to be done properly, though, where you actually know the money you're being told is real money. It's not money that's going to suddenly disappear a bit and, sorry mate, I thought I had 50 quid in my pocket, I've only got 20 now, you know, and that's the problem with all these issues is that the money that's there is suddenly not quite the money you thought it was when you came to pay for the new drug supply or pay for the new 4x4. So it seems to me that what everybody wants is one cohesive, you know, sort of platform to work together, but knowing what have we got, what is the cash there that we can use, and how are we going to make sure that that cash is best used? Because, for example, there are plenty of countries, and I know Swaziland is one of them, they've applied for funds, but they're up against the fact that maybe at different times in their governance, the funds haven't quite ended up where they should have done. So now they're being hit by that. So they might have a really good TB program, but they can't get the money on, they can't get their hands on the money. So how do we there police the funds that are there? You know, how do you police that within the countries rather than going, well, we're not going to give you the money because it might not end up where it's supposed to, because the whole time you're doing that, these TB programs are getting hit and patients are infecting other patients. So it seems to me we kind of almost need to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, that government was corrupt, that one was, that one's not, that one is. Let's draw a line in the sand. Let's now work out, how do we do this? How do we fix this? How do we get the money to where it needs to be?
I think I would just add that the problem is perhaps exacerbated by the lack of media coverage. I mean, yesterday was World TB Day, so, you know, there's suddenly a spate of coverage by some news organizations, but on the whole, there's very little coverage, I think, of TB. And perhaps linked to that, Josh could correct me on the figures here, or Jen Cates, in my colleague here. The Kaiser polls show that the American public think that an extraordinarily high percentage of the federal budget goes on foreign aid and global health in particular, when in fact less, as I think you all probably know, less than 1% of the budget.
On average, 28%.
And 28% think, I mean, that is really a mismatch in reality, and is definitely plays into this debate about where the US budget should go, I think. Do we have other questions, or is everyone waiting with a great anticipation to see the film this evening? And then you could, of course, follow up with I'm sure there'll be other opportunities to address many of these questions.
We will have live tweeting during the film, and then the day after on Wednesday there is a webinar where there'll be myself and a couple of other experts, proper experts rather than me, to answer any questions. So if you do watch the film, which I hope you all will, it's only 18 minutes. It's not a lot of time. It's a small part of your life. If you watch it and then you have other questions and thoughts, you think, oh, I wish I'd known this yesterday, you can come online at 3 o'clock tomorrow, and equally there is an opportunity to tweet out during the film while it's going out. Although I get really angry about that, because I think you should be watching the film, but I know we need it. So tweet out, or there's the web on 3 o'clock the next day.
So I'm going to thank our panelists for joining us today, and thank you for coming out in the snow to join us, and hope that you will indeed have the chance to watch this very powerful film. Thank you again.